From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, a new report finds a shift in how Milwaukee County handles youth justice. Then we visit a class about etiquette at Native American powwows.
Anything where eagle feather drops and touches the ground means that a warrior has fallen. And they have a whole, they stop the whole powwow just so they could have a ceremony just for that one eagle feather.
We revisit the history of Cardinal Stritch University, which shut its doors 2 years ago. And comedian Matt Walsh talks about the challenges of doing live improv.
Improv keeps you humble. It's that never-ending challenge of you never want to do the same scene twice, and it's completely spontaneous and made up in the spot, so you can't really coast on old jokes or old situations.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum explores the state of Milwaukee County's youth justice system. The report focuses on how the youth justice system has evolved since 2018 by comparing data trends before and after the pandemic. That includes the types of offenses and the number of referrals to the county's Children, Youth, and Family Services Division. Ashley Fisher is a senior research associate at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She shared the findings of the report with WUWM's Eddie Morales.
We looked at each stage of the youth justice system and that process, starting from referrals all the way to disposition, which is how a judge sentences a youth in the children's court, and on through various things that the youth might be court ordered into, such as programs or detention alternatives, or if they are in secure care, what's happening there. And when they're out, when they've completed their programming, or if they're out of, once they're out of secure care, do they recidivate later? And what does that look like?
And were there any key takeaways from that specifically?
Yes, there were a number of key takeaways. So one is that the number of referrals coming into the youth justice system are not a lot different from what was happening, say in 2023 and 2024 versus in 2018 before the pandemic. They're not a lot different. There's about 1,100 unique youth that come in, so that's individuals, and then there's about 1,500 referrals that are still coming into the system each year. But what we did find is that the types of referrals have changed. So there are more felony level offenses. At this point, it's a referral. They have not actually been found to be guilty of anything. They haven't been disposed by a judge. So it is just being accused of an offense. But what's coming in are more felony level referrals and fewer misdemeanor referrals somewhat. So there's a 13% increase in the felony level referrals and a 7% decrease in misdemeanor referrals, which suggests that the types of crimes happening are more serious, even if the same number of youth are coming in and out of the justice system. Mm-hmm.
And does the report go into any of the reasons why the severity of those referrals are heightened compared to previous?
We were not able to explore the reasons why the types of referrals were coming in. We did get a little more granular on what those more serious referrals are, what are the most common types of offenses, but not the reasons why. That said, I can share that we did dig into the demographics of the youth being referred to the county, and 78% of youth have a mental health condition or an alcohol or other substance abuse condition or both. That's 78% of total referrals there. So we're talking about 5,800 out of 7,400 youth from 2018 to 2023 carried some sort of condition coming in.
Those challenges also paired with some of the challenges of staffing and operations at facilities. Can you talk to how those two kind of come together, and what are some of those specific challenges that facilities face?
The Vell Phillips Center, which is the county's secure care facility, it's designed for short-term use. It has had some capacity challenges in recent years. So starting in late 2021 through mid-2023, there were 8 months in which the average daily population exceeded the maximum capacity of 127 beds. And then that seems to have subsided, but from August to December of 2024, four of those 5 months once again saw the increased population, and it was above the 127 bed threshold. And we do attribute that to the increases in the kinds of referrals coming in. So if you've got a youth coming in who is automatically referred to the adult court because of the severity of the crime, so they're automatically in it, or they're referred to the adult court, or youth who just have more serious crimes, but they're not in the adult system, all of that can increase the length of stay at the detention center. There's also a program that the county offers called the Milwaukee County Accountability Program. And that's made a big difference over time in allowing the youth to be sentenced by a judge who have more serious crimes, but they don't reach a severity that would require placement at a state facility, which is Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake out in Irma, Wisconsin. If their crimes aren't severe enough to require placement there, this is an alternative placement option that allows youth to stay closer to home. That program can have wait lists up to 6 to 12 weeks where the youth are in the Vell Phillips Center. They haven't started their program yet, and that can also take up bed capacity for other youth that might need, you know, the very shorter term stays as they're waiting for their court dispositions.
What are some of the challenges with assessing the collected data?
That is a great question. So we were able to track data on a number of fronts, like the referrals that I was speaking to, or we could get at the types of referrals happening. But when we started looking into program-specific data or recidivism data, what was available was more lacking. We have more questions coming out of this report than we have answers as far as, is the youth justice system creating better outcomes for youth? Are they recidivating later on in life, or are they becoming members of the community that don't come back into the justice system, whether as a youth or as an adult? The purpose of the youth justice system is rehabilitation for the youth. And the county has a number of detention alternatives for which they do track their admissions. The most popular is called Level 2, and that's a program. It's a sentencing option for judges where youth could be in home or in out of home care, and they're offered a range of supports. So they could be entered into any number of community services, such as mental or behavioral health or education or something to support them in parenting skills or family therapy, or, you know, whatever is specific to each youth, and they have an individualized case plan. That's another benefit happening at the county currently. Each youth is assigned a human services worker who is really there to support the youth and their families in implementing the case plan that the court assigns. Or if the youth doesn't hit the point of reaching a court order, they can still on that front end be designed a case plan to support them in their future. And so we found that overall across these, there's five programs where the county had readily available admission data. The number of youth being put into these alternative programs rather than a sentence that would place them in secure care has fallen somewhat over time. But that we also attribute to the fact that there's higher numbers of referrals that are linked to more serious offenses. So the youth that are causing more serious crimes can't go into these programs that have lower degrees of monitoring and less oversight. With these programs, there's a range of things that the county doesn't track. We couldn't get numbers on admissions or what's happening after, but they offer a range of clinical services, educational services, there's family support services. And what I can share is that the county had only 20 contracted service providers in 2014, and now there are 60 contracted service providers. So you really can get a sense that they have really expanded the amount of services available to support each youth as individuals according to what they need.
Mm-hmm. So there's work being done, but based on the key takeaways from this entire report, is there anything that the Wisconsin Policy Forum is kind of hoping the data can provide or inform the county on?
Mm-hmm. It would be really helpful if the county tracked recidivism beyond the narrow parameters that it currently uses. And so what I want to say here is that in 2015, the county sent 123 youth to state facilities. That's Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And by 2024, 18 were sent there. And that makes a big difference from a financial perspective, and it allows the county to use its resources, either funneling it back into other juvenile justice services or to other needs that the county has. We can't say where the savings went, but I can share that in 2015, with those 123 youth sent to a state facility, it cost $13.1 million. by 2024 by reducing the number of youth sent there every year. And again, that's because of the wider array of services available to judges for dispositions. It was only $7.4 million that year. So every year, because of that consistent effort to lower the number of youth being sent away to a state facility, the county saved anywhere between $4 and $7 million each year. There's another factor coming into play, though, which is that Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake have seen a shrinking population as a whole over time. It's not just fewer youth going there from Milwaukee County. And so the cost of running those facilities has not changed. They still have to pay for their staff. They still have to pay to operate the buildings. And so there's a smaller number of youth to divvy those costs across, and those costs are then charged back to counties. In July 2021, we saw a big rate change. The cost per kid per day went from $615 to, I want to say it was $1,178 per kid per day. So the county has been continuing to adjust, continuing to work to drop the numbers of youth sent there. I can share that in 2024 and coming into the spring of 2025, the numbers have started to increase again, the number of youth sent there. And so the county is really going to have to navigate cost increases in the future, and the savings it had been seeing might diminish, particularly because the annual cost or the expected change in the cost per kid per day that would take place in July of this year might go up to over $2,300 per youth per day. So that is a cost of over $800,000 a year to the county if it is implemented.
That was Ashley Fisher, a senior research associate at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Powwows are a dearly loved tradition in Native communities across the United States. For those who are outside of the powwow circle, coming to one for the first time means learning the written and unwritten rules of the sacred circle. Ahead of the annual Honor the Heartbeat powwow in May, the Gerald L. Ignace Indian Health Center hosted a powwow etiquette class to help community members prepare for the event. WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Maria Peralta Arellano reports.
Powwows are a tradition that dates back centuries. They're a way to share and preserve indigenous cultures among nations, and powwows have become long-awaited for events throughout the country. Strong drums fill the gatherings with a liveliness, only rivaled by the glittering regalia that fights for the attention of spectator eyes. Feathers fly to the beat of the drum, and the jingle of bells cascades over the crowd as the community celebrates the opening of the sacred circle. Every year, the powwow circle welcomes new visitors and dancers. The gatherings are social, and like all social events, there are rules. Kaylin Garza came to the Honor the Heartbeat powwow at the Expo Center in the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds. It was her first visit.
I really had no clue what to expect. I've never experienced anything like this before, so I was just really excited to kind of see what would go on.
The rules are so important because there's a spiritual meaning behind them. That's why learning the processes can enhance the experience for all those involved. While powwows are a common tradition, etiquette and practices may vary depending on the nation inviting the community, as they may do things differently according to their traditions. This year, to prepare for the powwow, the Gerald L. Ignace Indian Health Center held a powwow etiquette class. It welcomed both Native and non-Native community members. Marilyn Madash is a member of the Menominee Nation and the Intergenerational Programs Coordinator. She said this class is necessary to preserve powwow tradition.
Sometimes we just go through like our cultural, like the powwows, ceremonies through all different things and assuming that our own people know what it is. And then we're getting older, right? A lot of the elders left us already. So Danny's the next one in line. And I saw him coming out as well and explaining what, in his experiences of what powwow etiquette is to give the community that so they can also understand powwow etiquette and just in general.
The class was led by Daniel Preston, a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe and the Health Center's cultural and spiritual advisor, who is a powwow dancer himself. He says he wanted to lead this so the next generation of dancers, drummers, and spectators could avoid unnecessary mistakes.
I experienced some of that stuff firsthand, some of the stuff that happens inside the powwow circuit.
Preston covered topics such as grand entry. It's the opening ceremony of the powwow where spectators should stand if they're able, remove all headwear, and should refrain from speaking to give those in the circle their attention and respect. For dancers, Preston stressed the importance of keeping all regalia secure. Even a single eagle feather dropping could stop a whole powwow.
Anything where an eagle feather drops and touches the ground means that a warrior has fallen. And they have a whole, they stop the whole powwow just so they could have a ceremony just for that one eagle feather.
He also spoke about the types of songs that are played, the position of head dancers, and the direction of the powwow circle, and more. At the powwow, families and community organizations gather to spend a day together filled with culture and learn about mental health and wellness resources accessible to them. Kaylin Garza, who didn't know what to expect at her first recent powwow, had this reflection.
It's been really fascinating so far, but I didn't really have any preconceived ideas of what would happen because I really wasn't sure. So I was just going to kind of soak in whatever happened here.
Katie Platt was with Garza. She said she had no idea about powwow etiquette, but kept respect in mind.
Like Katie said, just kind of stand, observe, appreciate the culture, clap, kind of listen to the guy on the microphone, stand when you stand, sit when you're able to sit, kind of just respecting what is expected of us.
The powwow etiquette class was held to make sure those attending powwows this season had a reliable place to learn before attending. Here's Marilyn Madash of the Menominee Nation.
Well, they may or may not be taught at the powwow. They're just going to go through life assuming things, which is better to learn, right, from at least the Native people, the Native perspective.
While powwows are exciting community events, it's still a place of sacred meaning to Native communities in Wisconsin and across the country. Preserving the tradition means also passing down the rules and expectations of the powwow circle. I'm Eric Bonfellow, Maria Peralta Arellano, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you listen to your podcast to download and hear us on demand. Coming up later on in the show, we'll talk to comedian Matt Walsh about his upcoming improv performance here in Milwaukee. But first, we revisit the history of the now-closed Cardinal Stritch University. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been 2 years since Milwaukee's Cardinal Stritch University closed due to declining enrollment. During its more than 80 years in operation, Stritch was at one point one of the largest Franciscan institutions of higher education in North America. To learn about the history of the university, I went to the archives on campus to meet with Sarah Wolfel, the Cardinal Stritch University historian. We spoke during Stritch's last semester before closing in spring of 2023.
Any history of Cardinal Stritch University has to start with the sisters. And so I'm going to go well before 1937 to 1849. And that's when the founders of the sisters first stepped foot in Milwaukee. They came from Bavaria. They were invited by the bishop of the Diocese of Milwaukee, which was fairly new at the time. And they came here to serve the German immigrants that had settled in the Milwaukee area. And so from the very beginning, they were putting themselves at the service of the people of Milwaukee, but their heart was with Christian education. And so they had really hoped that they could start a congregation of religious sisters here and eventually branch out into education. And that's something they eventually did, but they had to settle and they had to get their footing first. And they were at the service of the St. Francis de Sales Seminary when it was brand new. So it took them a while to get to education, but as we all know by their history, they not only got to serve in education, but have affected thousands upon thousands of people all over the world because of that.
It's in the name. There's the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi. And when this was first founded, it was called St. Clair College. So can you briefly go over who were St. Francis and St. Clair, and of course, the Franciscan values that Cardinal Stritch is centered upon?
Well, the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi were actually the first vowed Franciscan women to be established in the United States. And so from the very beginning, those Franciscan roots were at the heart of who they were. St. Francis of Assisi, he started in a very humble way, just wanting to live in the poverty that would allow him to better serve and know God. It was kind of a radical approach to service, and you know, especially because he came from a wealthy family, it shocked people the way that he served. So little by little, more and more men followed him, and St. Clair was one of the women, the first women to follow him. She also left her wealthy family in order to embrace this life of poverty and service. And so they are giants in the Franciscan tradition.
And can we go over those four Franciscan values? Students who go here, they're required to take Franciscan-infused core classes just to get familiar with it. But also each year, the university picks a value to highlight each year. What are they?
Well, this year, our value is compassion, which actually fits very well in this time. We're seeing a lot of compassion during this time. Creating a caring community is another one of them. Peacemaking and reverencing all creation. The sisters are at the heart of that. They articulated those values for the first time in the 1980s because they recognized that the Sisters of St. Francis, who used to be in all areas of the university as faculty, as staff, you couldn't go anywhere without encountering a sister. Their numbers were starting to diminish in the 1980s. So they saw that it was really important to articulate those values so that the people who were left, the lay people who would be working alongside them, could understand what was at the heart of this university from the very beginning and carry that on. And to this day, we have one Sister of St. Francis of Assisi still working here, but we have hundreds, thousands of people who can articulate these values and are living them out in our community today.
You mentioned when this college was first formed, you could scarcely go anywhere without encountering a sister. Can you speak a little bit more upon those early years from Stritch when it was first founded?
The reason it was founded is because the sisters, you know, they were going into education and they were going into schools, but they didn't have proper teacher training. And so they would do the training at their convent. Eventually, they founded something called St. Catherine's Normal School, which is kind of a loose forerunner of Stritch, because they were trying to form their sisters because there was such a demand for teachers at the time, and they needed to get them out into the schools, but you know, they wanted them to be properly trained. So eventually, they started to send them to colleges and universities around the state, around the country, so they could get advanced degrees and methods. But around 1932, there was an unusually large number of sisters who needed training, and so they were looking for ways to get all of them the training that they needed without having to pay out the money for tuition at other schools. And so one of our sisters who was in charge of this, she actually went to the Archbishop at the time, and that was Samuel Stritch. And she said, "I don't know what to do. We have all these sisters that need training and we don't have enough money, you know, to send them out." And so he said, "You know, sister, your congregation is large enough now. You can actually start your own college." And so it was at his urging that the school actually started in 1932 as a teacher training college just for the Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi. It quickly changed. They quickly started to embrace other religious orders and bring them in. And by 1946, they started to admit lay women. So it quickly took shape. It started as something very simple and very practical, and it didn't take long before it began to serve a wider population.
You mentioned Archbishop Stritch. So in 1946, the school was also renamed after him, Samuel Alphonsus Stritch. So can you share a little bit more about him and what his local impact was?
Well, he was the Archbishop here before he was then called to be the Archbishop of Chicago, the Archdiocese of Chicago, where he was then named Cardinal. So that's where the name Cardinal comes from here. And I think he was called sometimes the Archbishop of Charity, because he would say, you know, as long as I have two pennies in my hand, one belongs to the poor. So he just really had a heart for people in need. And this was especially during the time that Stritch was founded, during the Great Depression, you know, that really resonated with the sisters because there was a lot of hardship around. There were a lot of people in need. So because he was such an advocate for education as well, the sisters in 1946 had approached him and asked him whether they could name the school for him. And at that time, it was not just Cardinal Stritch College, it was called the Cardinal Stritch College. But he said, yes, as long as you always serve people in need. He He wouldn't have wanted his name on a school that didn't have that at its heart. And I think you can trace our whole history and you can see that that is still very much how we operate today.
So we are here in the archives. Can you explain kind of what's all housed in here?
It's a lot of our records, our academic records, our departmental records. There's also lots of photographs, old publications. One of my favorite things is these old newspapers that we have. We had this award-winning publication from the late 40s to sometime in the 80s. And it was all student-run. So, and it's just, it's their student voices just coming out of those newspapers. We also have some artifacts from Cardinal Stritch himself. We have trophies and, you know, just knickknacks and you pretty much can feel the history down here. So what's beautiful about Cardinal Stritch University is a lot of their ministries kind of converged here. One thing I haven't mentioned is that throughout our history with the sisters being here, they weren't just holding space. They were innovating things. They were creating curriculum around special education. We had one of the first reading clinics in the Midwest was formed here, and it was because our sisters were at the cutting edge of trying to teach people to read.
That's one major impact, and this school was known for its education program, amongst many other things. What else stands out to you about the ways that the sisters not only innovated, but conducted themselves and cemented a unique place in the field of higher education?
Yeah, I can name a whole bunch of sisters who were known on a national or international level. When they would innovate that curriculum, a lot of times they would share it. This became a place that people would come to learn special education methods so they could take them to the world. So it's just, when you think about the impact of that, it's so far reaching. I think if you would talk to a lot of the residential students who knew them, the sisters and the students often lived in common ways or common spaces. They'd share meals together. So in addition to these women wanting to form these younger women, you know, to be leaders in society and to form them for their careers, they also had these mothering hearts for them. So I think their legacy is going to be that they put everything that they had into this place. One thing I haven't mentioned is that the sisters contributed their salaries back to Stritch. They didn't take salaries, so it's called contributed services. And they actually, in the year 1968 to 69, their contributed services totaled $430,000. So that was 31% of the college's budget at the time. That was their contributed services because they knew that this ministry was important. And so they gave everything that they had. You hear stories all the time of the sister who, with her PhD, would be teaching in the classroom during the day. And at night, she'd be running the switchboard, or she wouldn't be afraid to, you know, help out in the kitchen or clean the bathrooms. They did not know the limits of hierarchy. They didn't see it that way. This was their school, and they all came ready to serve. So they just have beautiful hearts, and they're still on the south side of Milwaukee. They're so pleased with what Cardinal Stritch University has meant to the community. So even at this closing, they're, you know, sad, but they're celebrating it as opposed to mourning it because they just know what it has meant to people.
Sarah Wolfel was the university historian at Cardinal Stritch University. We spoke 2 years ago before the school closed. In the 1920s, amid an international pandemic, rising rates of tuberculosis and smallpox, and racial disparities in health outcomes, the Black Cross Nurses were founded. The Black Cross Nurses served Black patients who were ignored by establishment public health institutions. Do for Self, the story of Milwaukee's Black Cross Nurses, was an exhibit at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society that chronicled the foundation of the Black Cross Nurses here in Milwaukee. Lake Effect Sam Woods visited the exhibit in 2023 to learn about the nurses from museum staff and met with today's health workers who see themselves reflected in the exhibit.
Vanessa Johnson was born 2 months early, at just over 2 pounds. Her mother was visiting Milwaukee during the 4th of July when she went into labor, while everyone around her dismissed her concerns.
And so, as you can suspect, she's coming here to just enjoy the holiday, and she went into labor. And no one believed her. They didn't think she was in labor. They told my father that he can go back to Indiana because my mother's just constipated. And so she was left to be alone in a hospital room laboring for hours at a time. And it wasn't until about 8 hours or so later that the doctor finally came in the room to check on her, and they could see me. I was coming out. And so they were frantic and like, oh my goodness. And I was born.
Today, Vanessa is a reproductive health lactation nurse, doula birth worker, and yoga instructor with an emphasis on prenatal and postpartum health. She says that she chose this work due to her birth story and how her mother was largely left alone and ignored while Vanessa was born.
And so in an unfamiliar place, ill-prepared, not being listened to, and as a Black woman, you know, birthing in the 70s, the idea of not being listened to, your voice not being heard, is still continuing to this day. And so I really felt like somehow, some way, if I could provide a sense of peace in that moment for other families, then like, job well done.
But when I met Vanessa, she was fighting back tears of joy, as we were both learning about Milwaukee's long history of Black healthcare workers volunteering to provide medical care for Black residents and combat racial disparities in health outcomes over 100 years ago. We were at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum's new exhibit, Do for Self, the story of Milwaukee's Black Cross Nurses. The exhibit chronicles the foundation and story of the Milwaukee chapter of the Black Cross Nurses, which was a group of Black nurses dedicated to providing public health services to Black people, with chapters in Milwaukee, as well as places as far away as Nova Scotia and Panama. But before we get into the Milwaukee chapter of the Black Cross Nurses and Vanessa's connection to them, we need to establish some context, starting a little over 100 years ago, with Marcus Garvey and the UNIA.
Fellow citizens of Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Improvement Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million Negroes of the world.
That's Marcus Garvey, speaking in 1921 about the goals of a new organization he had founded, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or UNIA. Starting in Garvey's home country of Jamaica, the long-term goals of the UNIA centered on political and economic autonomy for the Black diaspora and encouraged a self-reliant Black nationalism. This is where the exhibit's Do for Self title comes from. Now, at the same time that the UNIA was getting going and Marcus Garvey was recording this speech in the early 1920s, the need for adequate public health services was impossible to ignore.
Every year in America, there are more than 100,000 new cases of tuberculosis. Of all infectious diseases, tuberculosis is still the greatest killer.
Tuberculosis, measles, and smallpox remain prevalent, and the flu pandemic of 1918 caught the world by surprise in a manner similar to COVID-19, leading to thousands of people dying and the widespread use of masks and social distancing. Public health institutions like the American Red Cross were in place to aid in these emergencies. But Black people did not receive the same level of care as white people from these types of establishment institutions. So, in 1920, Henrietta Vinton Davis, a UNIA member and follower of Marcus Garvey, founded the first chapter of the Black Cross Nurses in Philadelphia. Soon, Black Cross Nurse chapters popped up in conjunction with the UNIA all over North and Central America and the Caribbean. As Claiborne Benson, historian and executive director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, explains, the Black Cross Nurses took Garvey's Do for Self idea and applied it to public health. They performed regular home and hospital visits, administered needed medicine, and cared for pregnant women and new mothers who were ignored by establishment health institutions.
The Black Cross Nurses served that purpose by going to their homes, by treating them in their beds and caring for the issues that existed inside their house that makes their wellness becoming reality through clean house and through dishwashers and children. But they did even more than that. Many of them delivered babies, and they brought medicines from the drugstore to solve people's problems. They did all sorts of things because they actually cared about the people themselves. They saw it as being part of the Marcus Garvey movement, number one, and number two, helping to solve the problems of our people, and that being health issues, tuberculosis, when others did not want to or were reluctant to treat our people.
Milwaukee would get its chapter of the Black Cross Nurses in 1921, when Hattie Fountain, a member of Milwaukee's UNIA chapter, started organizing volunteers to start a chapter here. Not only did Hattie start the chapter, but she kept detailed notes of the nurses' activities here in Milwaukee, which provide the basis for the exhibit at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. In her diary, Hattie describes making house calls, seeing people in her home, and traveling to hospitals to visit people sick with various ailments. She also documents going to the train station to give smallpox inoculations, how the Black Cross nurses performed services similar to birth doulas, who would guide people through caring for themselves during pregnancy, as well as organize mutual aid for new mothers. The diary also described day-to-day life working for the UNIA, from cataloging membership certificates and meeting notes to stories of police raids in her home. As Wisconsin Black Historical Society Program Director Jamila Benson explains, this type of day-to-day documentation of Black Cross nurse activities in the 1920s is rare anywhere, despite the organization having chapters in dozens of countries.
It's really exciting. There are historians who are going to find out that this is actually written and want to know more about it. I want to read what she wrote. Because in my studies and in my research about Black Cross nurses, there's very little. There's information on Lady Davis, who started the Black Cross nurses, but to talk about an individual nurse and her day-to-day activity is really rare.
The Black Cross nurses continued this work in Milwaukee until the early 1950s, when Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy started fueling anti-communist suspicions nationwide. Here he is making a speech in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, using, quote, lumberjack tactics to hack away at alleged communist activity.
As long as I am in the Senate, this task is not going to become a dainty task. If anyone wants to come in and remove them in some dainty fashion, they're welcome to it. But in the absence of that, if lumberjack tactics are the only kind of tactics that crowd understands, and take my word for it, those are the kind of tactics we're going to use on them, as long as there is one there endangering the lives of 150 million American people.
Now, McCarthy tended to focus his tirades in the early 1950s on supposed communist infiltration of U.S. government agencies and the military, not in the UNIA or Black Cross nurses specifically. However, over the years, his continued rhetoric fueled suspicion of these secret communist agents lurking everywhere, and Claiborne said that this caused the Black Cross nurses to fade away in Milwaukee because they feared becoming political prisoners.
Because the FBI and other government agencies would press people with, what are you doing? What are you guys saying in this meeting? That kind of thing. And that's the one thing that stopped the movement. Now, that's in the early 1950s, but throughout the 30s and the 40s, the Marcus Garvey movement is still alive.
But if you ask Vanessa Johnson, who we met at the beginning of the segment, about the impact of the Black Cross nurses, she'd say their lessons and their experience live on. Beginning from her birth, where her mother did not receive adequate health care, to her work now as a nurse and doula, Johnson saw herself in the exhibit. She saw herself in both the obstacles that she and the Black Cross nurses faced, and in the shared resolution to improve Black health outcomes.
Across the health sector, you know, the disparities are through the roof. And so, you know, it's important to know the history, to know about all of the pioneers who came before us, so that we can continue to do this work, because it can weigh heavy on your heart, your spirit, on your mental health. But to know that we are, again, from the work that was done, that we have made strides, that we have made advances, but to know that there's still so much more to do. We have to keep pushing, and we have to keep fighting. And so that really drives me, where I think there's a quote that says, you know, like, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams, right? And so we can't give up. We have to keep going.
Cause a sensation, independent, also liberal. It was essential. Socialist was glad. Communist was sad.
That was Lake Effect Sam Woods speaking with the Wisconsin Black Historical Society's Clay Borden and Jamila Benson, as well as Vanessa Johnson, a registered nurse and doula. Do for Self, the story of Milwaukee's Black Cross nurses, was on display at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society in 2023. We've got a new season of Bulber Talk on the way, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions you've always wondered about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about the art of improv with comedian Matt Walsh. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you're a fan of comedic films or TV shows, chances are you're familiar with Matt Walsh. He's perhaps best known as one of the founding members of the Upright Citizens Brigade, an improv sketch comedy group that's had both stage and television shows. Walsh is returning to the stage once again, this time with Bluebird Improv. He'll be in Milwaukee this coming Sunday at the Pabst Theater, alongside a star-studded cast that includes former SNL cast member Tim Meadows. Walsh joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of the performance to talk about his work.
So you have done a lot of things in your career, TV, films, and of course you are one of the co-founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade, also known as UCB. What is it that keeps you coming back to the stage, and specifically improv?
Improv keeps you humble. It's that never-ending challenge of, you never want to do the same scene twice, and it's completely spontaneous and made up in the spot, so you can't really coast on old jokes or old situations. And you use the audience and you bring them with you, so that connection with the audience, meeting them, interviewing them, and then using that information to inspire comedic scenes, it's sort of getting on a journey with that crowd and winning them over that I really love. And I also love that I play with really funny people, so I inevitably laugh a lot.
Yeah, speaking of those very funny people, it's a pretty star-studded cast here. Can you tell us a bit about them?
So the roster for our improv show called Bluebird is Tim Meadows from many movies and Saturday Night Live, Brad Morris, a Chicago Second City and television actor, and Joe Canale, also a Chicago Second City and TV actor. We travel around and we're coming to Milwaukee, and those are my cohorts.
It's kind of an interesting concept, right? You go to a show where you fundamentally don't know what's going to happen. It hasn't been written. The actors also don't know what's going to happen. Tell us a bit about the setup of this show.
We come out with a completely blank slate. We sort of share with each other live on stage what is on our minds. Could be news, could be the city we're in. And then we start to meet people in the audience and talk to them and find out what's on their mind and what we find interesting in them. We sort of interview them and always stumble into some interesting stuff, because people inevitably have all these different concerns or opinions or life experiences. And then we use those interviews to begin scene work that we, the performers, control by grounding it in reality, playing it in reality, initiating premises, and then connecting the scenes as if it was a one-act play. And so that is what we've all been trained in Chicago. It's called long-form improvisation. And so the preparation is really just to make yourself present, to engage the audience, and to support to the top of your intelligence the people you're on stage with. That's the sort of skill set that we bring to every show.
It's definitely something that takes a lot of trust, but also a lot of training, a lot of, you know, knowing how to move the story forward. How have you built that trust with the people you work with?
I think we've all had similar training. We're sort of tradesmen in this skill called long form improvisation. So we know that we have to let go of our ideas and support whatever our partner just said. We have to commit to these imaginary circumstances 100%. You can't phone it in. You can't like say, if someone says, "Doctor, I have a rash," you can't say like, "Well, I'm not a doctor. You're in the wrong room." You have to commit 100% to the reality that they've initiated. And that's kind of like the trust is experience. You know, we've been around the world. We went to London and Barcelona and Maine, and, you know, we've done shows around. And I think that gives you real trust, just the experience of being in various situations and having to deliver. Yeah, that's my hot take on trust.
Kind of with the same idea of trust in mind, I think there are a lot of audiences that are very leery of improv. Many of us have seen bad improv. How do you assure people who are in the audience who are planning to attend that, look, we're professionals. We know what we're doing when we get on stage.
I too have seen bad improv, and I am gun shy to go see an improv show at times unless I know that the people performing are very funny and clever. How would I tell people that this is guaranteed to be funny? I can only say that everybody on the stage is very hilarious, and we're very quick on our feet, and we're very committed, and we work really hard to deliver a good show every time. And we bring the audience with us. They're a big part of it. So we interact with them, and we choose what we find interesting in that room. And I think we all have such different backgrounds that it's a great blend of perspectives and ideas and that reflect the sort of audience and room that we're in.
Presumably in Milwaukee, that will reflect drinking.
Yeah, I mean, there are personalities to each town, and drinking probably is not unique to Milwaukee, but yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of drinking tales in Milwaukee. I'm certain its history reflects that. It's brewery history. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I look forward to it. It's funny, we went to London and we sort of wanted to meet the audience and talk to them. And they're very like timid. They feel like, oh, if I talk, I'm ruining the show. And if you ask them a question, they kept it very short and wanted you to talk to someone else. And so what we're used to is sort of like picking one person, having like a 5-minute interview, and then telling the audience, okay, we don't need any information anymore. And we use all that to inspire scene work, and the audience recognizes what we've used. And so it's just interesting, different towns, the sort of information and the willingness to participate.
Like a lot of public radio personalities, I opened for David Sedaris when he was here. I just, you know, announced him. Not opened, that's the wrong way to put that. I announced him. And before I went out, he said, "Watch out, they're drunk out there." And I said, "Oh, well, you know, they pre-gamed." And he said to me, what does that mean? And I said, they drank before they got here. He went, oh, so they don't have to pay the high prices at the... And I went, no. They're also going to drink when they're here, but they also wanted to be a little drunk before they came. So I think sometimes we get people who are very familiar with a lot of cities and they don't realize the level of drunkenness that is about to befall them in the city of Milwaukee. So I would like to caution you that pick your audience member very carefully.
This is good advice. I appreciate the, we're doing a little recon here. That is good to know, because you do have to like create a respectful barrier. Like, you don't want people participating throughout the show. Like, you have a moment where you meet them and you have laughs with them and you share stories with them, or they share stories with you. And then you cut it off and say, okay, now this is our part of the show, so sit back and enjoy. So yeah, you can't tell who's going to be really drunk. And generally, we've never had a problem with like disruptive audiences, because I think people want to see what we're going to do. But that's a good caution. I appreciate the advice and the heads up.
They do usually hold it in. You know, they can hold their liquor.
Well, it's a classy venue, right? It's a nice venue, right? I think that helps. People tend to respect the room they're in. So we dress up nice. We take showers and we look clean. So it's not like... it's not going to feel like street busking.
Good, good. With Milwaukee in mind, what are you looking forward to on your return to the city?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'd love to like just like walk around, obviously get some food. And I don't know how much time we're going to have, but Spring by Lake Michigan is going to be fantastic. So I'll be excited for the nice weather in the Midwest. And so I'm sure we'll get up to some trouble and meet some friends and have a nice dinner. But, you know, I'm not going to raise hell or anything.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. And we are looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee.
Thank you very much, Joy. I appreciate it.
Matt Walsh is an actor, comedian, and co-founder of the Upright Citizens Brigade. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers ahead of his performance with Bluebird Improv at the Pabst Theater this Sunday. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excrete Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Eddie Morales, Maria Peralta Arellano, Mayan Silver, and Jimmy Gutierrez from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to meet one of the folks that repairs MCTS buses and learn about the program that trained her to become a mechanic. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.